Well, the federal assumption during this talk will be that quantum Einstein gravity, abbreviated QEG, is the correct theory of gravity on all length scales. During the past few years, there has been some increasing evidence that this theory is asymptotically safe, that it is non-perturbatively normalizable, and that would make it a valid fundamental theory of gravity. I assume that this is actually the case. Personally, I believe that this is really true. We can have different opinions, but for the purposes of this talk, let's assume it is non-perturbatively renormalizable, and so the natural question is, or the goal is, as in any theory of validity down to the smallest possible scales, you should be able to derive predictions which you can test on, let's say, macroscopic or much larger scales. It's the same problem as in QED, for instance, or as in the standard model in general. Technically speaking, the problem we are facing is we would like to compute something like the defective action for the metric field, G mu mu, the metric being the fundamental degrees of freedom. So this argument here is the expectation value sort of, and this is the standard effective action. Now, you could follow the textbook. Just a question.
Oh, yeah, I didn't mean to interrupt you in the middle of your sentence. You said that you'll assume that gravity is asymptotically safe, but if you're interested in astrophysical applications, why do you need that assumption?
No, for those applications, it's not important. The astrophysical part of this talk could be discussed within an effective theory of gravity, and asymptotic safety would not be a relevant issue. I'm mentioning that because in the second part of this talk, I will follow the renormalization group trajectory all the way down from the ultraviolet to the infrared, and this general picture which I'm going to draw, that will assume that I will present some evidence for that there is asymptotic safety, but you are right, so it's not important. So, actually what I'm going to do is not to follow the standard particle approach to compute gamma, but rather consider or adopt the Wilsonian point of view. From the point of view of the Wilsonian renormalization group, this task of computing this functional is equivalent to solve a corresponding renormalization group equation for the Wilsonian effective action from the ultraviolet from distance zero, if you wish, to the infrared, to distance infinity, so from the smallest sub-Planckian distances to galactic or cosmological scales, say. And what I would like to convince you of is that this problem is a highly non-perturbative one in many respects, reminiscent of the problems we encounter in QCE in the infrared sector. I will follow a double strategy. First of all, I will show some analytical results we obtained for the small distance behavior of the theory. So this analytical part is concerned mostly with the ultraviolet aspect. And I will combine it at a sort of phenomenological level with observational data, which concern mostly the infrared sector of the theory. And I will combine these two pieces of information in order to characterize the renormalization group trajectory of this theory as it is selected by nature. So my attitude will be, I assume QEG is the correct theory, so there exists a certain renormalization group trajectory which nature has selected. And then the natural question is, what are the parameters of this trajectory? How can I fix them? What are the special features of this specific trajectory?
I have one question about your analogy with QCD. So in QCD, the UV and the infrared degrees of freedom are not the same.
Yes.
With here you're assuming that...
I mean, precisely speaking, you cannot say that they are not the same. You should say it is inconvenient use them, and the same is the situation here, but I will not be able for the time being to change to more appropriate variables. And perhaps those derived by John are used in these models, they might be the appropriate, more appropriate variables than the metric in the extreme infrared. But this is something I have no results on yet, and everything is formulated in terms of a non-local action of the metric. Okay, so this is the plan of my talk. In the first part, in just one page, very briefly, I will describe the schema I'm using, the so-called effective average action. Then in the second part, I will show you these analytic results we obtained so far for the running of Newton's constant and the cosmological constant. And in this context, I will briefly mention the general ideas about non-perturbative renormalizability one can formulate in this context. Then, as for infrared properties, I will give a closer look to the flow equations in the so-called Einstein-Hilbert approximation, and I will show that in this approximation, which is analytically under control, that this approximation predicts not only a strong renormalization, strong renormalization effects in the ultraviolet, but also in the extreme infrared. There is some analytical evidence for strong renormalization effects also at large distances. So this is still analytic, and then I will move on to a sort of topological, just topological classification of the renormalization trajectories, which in principle could be realized in nature, and I will describe the one using observational data, the value of the cosmological constant and so on, to pinpoint which one exactly is realized. Then the sixth part is what is mentioned in the title, speculations upon astrophysical applications. It's purely phenomenological, based on these infrared, potential infrared instabilities. I will show you two models, in particular one on galaxies, where model means assumptions on plausible normalization group flows, which would first of all describe or explain why the universe seems to accelerate since recently, and also might why this trajectory might give rise to a modification of Newton's constant and Newton's law of galactic schedules. Now, let's start with a one-page review of the so-called effective average action. I'm omitting all technical issues. Just what I would like to mention is the formula we are using is a specific implementation of Lose's ideas about force training, about exact renormalization group flows applied to the evaluation of path integrals over metrics of this form. In the Wilsonian context, the evaluation of a path integral or formal partition function of this sort is transcribed into the problem of solving a certain renormalization group flow, namely of finding the so-called effective average action gamma. It depends on the metric and on an infrared scale K. Loosely speaking, this K is introduced in such a way that in this integral, only modes of the metric with covariant momenta larger than K are integrated out, whereas the other ones, the infrared ones, the low wavelength modes, are left untouched. In our construction, this functional interpolates between the bare action S, sometimes called the classical action, which is something smaller, and the ordinary effective action gamma. Essentially, it's a Lechendre transform of this integral with sources added and cutoffs added. The point is that this functional defines an effective field theory at an effective length scale of the order k to the minus 1, meaning that just deriving the effective field equations from gamma k, you get a set of equations which, when you solve it, encapsulates all the quantum effects which are dominant at the scale k. Now, how do you find this functional? You can derive from the primary path integral definition a flow equation on the space of such functionals, gamma of g mu mu, which is written in a symbolic language here. I'm not going to explain any technical details, just you have the scale derivative of gamma t, the renormalization group time log k, and then on the right-hand side you have a certain extremely complicated beta functional gamma 2 in the Hessian of this functional, but don't worry about the details. Just keep in mind it is a way of implementing this cutoff of infrared nodes.
So K is that the eigenvalue of the
D'Alembert? No, but it cuts off the eigenvalues of the D'Alembert. It's a lower bound, if you wish, on those eigenvalues retained in the quantum.
I'm a little confused here. So the action S that you had in the first line, you said that's called the classical action?
Yeah, I said it's a misnomer.
Okay, so but does that actually contain all the quantum fractions?
No, not at all. And in fact, it's a totally irrelevant quantity in a certain sense. First of all, this equation does not contain S. S is the starting point.
This is the initial condition.
Yes,
this in a sense,
yes.
And so I have the equation, but you also need the initial condition.
Yes, but we don't postulate it a priori, we compute it. And I come to that on the next transparency.
Yeah.
It's just in a standard field theory, S would be 1/4 F squared in Daniels, for instance, and that enters only as the initial condition. Or statistical mechanics, it would be the simple easing interaction for spin
systems. But then the classical equations of motion don't contain all quantum effects, right?
Now, they look classical, but they are the classical in quotes equations of motion for gamma k, and if k is zero, you have the ordinary effective action, and this is well known to contain all quantum effects.
When you take away the cutoff, there are certainly some quantum fractions, right? So gamma, when k goes to infinity, should not be S.
Strictly speaking, there is a difference, and the difference is something like trace log of an operator with an infinite mass. So there are some trivial denormalizations in terms of the order. But that's not important for the
Isn't monitor to do as an initial condition something like in the log and infrared here, Einstein action?
But also
don't mean in the
I'm not saying anything about yet that what we know empirically is that in the infrared we have something like
I don't do it.
Can I make a suggestion?
Yeah.
Which is we discussed a lot of science. Sorry. But we'll let Mark go a little bit further and we see the whole problem. And then we can discuss a bit of time.
Can I ask what R sub k is? Have you told us that?
No, I said you should not worry. R sub k is an operator which suppresses the higher momentum modes. If you add it, you add something like h mu mu r h mu mu to the action. It is an operator which controls the transition from integrating out modes to not integrating out modes. it just belongs to what I said is the implementation of Wilson's ideas, and it's just a way to do this course training. But your question will be answered in a moment.
Okay. Also, can you,
this means the matrix of second functional derivatives is the Hessian in the operatorial sense. But this equation, it always looks like that. It's not specific to gravity, and it has been applied to many standard theories. And there are also other, for instance, the Wegener-Houghton equations are on the market, and I believe all our results are reproduced with those other exact equations on the market. So I would not overly stress our own formulation. And if you are not familiar with this approach, don't worry. I expect all these results can be reproduced with any of these equations which have been used during the past 10 years. Now, but the sort of universal problem is you have to solve this equation somehow, and really solving it exactly is equivalent to the complete solution of the path integral, which is impossible. So we have to do some sort of approximation. And the approximation which here suggests itself is truncating the space of action functionals, for instance, by making an ansatz of this form, but allowing the coefficients of the various invariants to depend on the scale k. What I'm going to discuss in the following is the so-called Einstein-Hilbert truncation, which retains only the R term and the cosmological constant term. We also did calculations with more general ansatz. It's convenient to rewrite the equations in terms of dimensionless couplings. The dimensionless Newton constant is k squared times capital G, and little lambda is the dimensionful lambda divided by k squared. Now, if you use this ansatz, plug it into this flow equation and project the flow onto this two-dimensional space spanned by these two variables, then you get something which is comparatively simple, just a system of two coupled differential equations, ordinary differential equations, coupling the flow of little g and little lambda with a beta function for g involving a certain anomalous dimension, eta n, which controls the flow of capital G in this way, and you have a lambda for lambda beta function. They are written here. The details are not important. There is only one aspect of these beta functions which I would like to stress, and this aspect is that contain certain integrals involving this R function we're asking about. And these functions, the beta functions, they all have singularities when little lambda, the dimensionless cosmological constant, equals 1/2. So strictly speaking, the flow defined by the system of differential equations is a flow on the half plane, arbitrary and lambda smaller than 1/2. I can make this much more explicit by adopting a specific cutoff scheme, a sharp cutoff, for which the equations boil down to the single system. And you see here you have a first order pole, and here you have an logarithmic divergence. The phi's are just constants. And you see when lambda approaches 1/2 from below, the beta functions blow up, meaning that capital lambda blows when it approaches 1/2 k squared, triggers an enormous enhancement of the beta functions. But this simple system you can put on a computer and just derive the flow on the RG plane. This is the dimensionless Newton constant here, the cosmological constant 1/2 is here, so this is the boundary of the theory space, what you see is basically three glass trajectories. First of all, you have two fixed points here at the origin, the so-called Gauss fixed point, and here.
So the arrow points in which direction?
The arrows are downward in the direction of increasing k. So this is the natural flow direction of increasing force strain. So this means when you are at some point in the upper half plane, for instance, and you increase the scale, you are always attracted into this fixed point. It has complex critical exponents, so you follow certain spirals before you do it.
So this is your point.
Yes, so this is the infrared, and in the infrared we have three different cases. Either you flow to negative lambda, or you follow this so-called separatrix, the fixed point, or you flow towards the positive lambda. And here for negative Q, that's not the important problem.
Not to start off too much, but do you mind going back and saying what the difference was the relative beta functions? The most you went very quickly through the most important thing, which is the generation of beta functions. So is that a bundle calculation?
No, that's basically a standard kind of calculation in this framework. You just insert the ansatz into the left hand side of the abstract flow equation. And then you project the flow, so to speak, on the space of these two invariants. In practice, it means to evaluate the trace on the right-hand side up to terms in a derivative expansion, up to terms containing second-order derivatives of the metric. So in practice, you can do this calculation by a simple one loop style calculation, but it has nothing to do with loop expansion. The approximation is the truncation and no approximation beyond that. So there is no approximation beyond restricting the functional form of the running action. So the approximation is, in general, I have this infinite dimensional manifold of all functional schema of loop. And my approximation is I consider only functionals of the type constant times square root g plus another constant times square root gr. This is the truncation of the space of actions.
So what would you say? It's otherwise exact. It's exact in the direction of variable g.
Yes.
Given that you set other variables to zero.
Exactly. It's not an expansion little g, and in fact it's not infinite high orders of little g contributions are summed up in this manner. And by the way, this term exact in the sense of exact flow equation, this is the word Wilson uses to emphasize the difference compared to perturbation. Theory converted to phenomenization, but it just tells you keep all the irrelevant terms also. But there was a question,
but this will flow that goes towards positive lambda. Does that hit that in a finite time? Or
That's exactly the main topic of this talk. I'll come to this in a moment. It hits it at a finite k. Thank you for this question.
Okay. The other question was, so far you force the action to remain local.
Yes.
You haven't allowed any non-local terms yet.
Yes.
Not
only
local,
it's very restricted.
Does the initial condition then vary?
The initial condition you see here is, that is now, this is also something on the next transparency. The initial condition taken in the construction of what we call QEG is precisely the ultraviolet fixed point. This is the idea of asymptotic safety. This is Weinberg's old idea, namely not to have any a priori prejudice about the bare action, but to construct, to compute the bare action in such a way that this limit of infinite cutoff can be taken in a safe way, and safe means to flow into the ultraviolet fixed point. This is listed.
So your truncated action also has a coverage of region squared.
Not in the calculations I'm showing you in this talk, but we did it also with Ritchie squared. And generally speaking, it has all sorts of higher terms. And the point is, the ultraviolet fixed point, its existence is crucial for the non-perturbative normalizability. What we find is this fixed point exists just for Einstein-Hilbert. Adding Ritchie squared changes almost nothing. And our belief is that allowing an arbitrary general ansatz, making no approximation, still would leave the fixed point intact. But it's a point in this infinite dimensional space away from the plane of G and lambda.
So the flow is stable.
That's the result of this, of a very many analyses we did, and which are quite technical, and I'm not going into the details of that, but all these analyses on stability like indicate that it's close to, according to me, close to impossible, that it's an accident to an improper approximation, this fixed point. There are too many miracles going on in this sense.
If you have a question?
Go ahead, very carefully.
Okay, so this is just revealing with the Gaussian and the non-Gaussian fixed point. At the non-Gaussian, the capital G behaves in this manner, G star is the fixed point coordinate, meaning that K, when you send K to infinity, capital G goes to zero, so it's an asymptotically free coupling. The dimensional Newton constant vanishes into deep ultraviolet while lambda blows up. Now here again, in the lower part, I mentioned the non-perturbative construction of quantum Einstein gravity. The idea is simply to use, for k going to infinity, the initial point of the trajectory, to equate this initial point with a fixed point whose existence we are sort of motivating, and that to define the theory by following the trajectory from this fixed point down to the infrared at the end point you are at the ordinary effective action then. And you see why this is called safe, because in this manner you can use up an infinite amount of renormalization through time, being sure that the trajectory does not do strange, uncontrolled things, because it spends most of the time at the fixed point, so to speak. And this is Weinberg's old idea, which now can be made precise in this calculational scheme. Now I'm coming back to your question about the termination of the trajectory running to positive mass. First of all, this kind of trajectory running to negative lambdas can be continued reliably to k equals zero, and also this one, we call them of type 1a and 2a. They don't show anything special in the infrared. Below the planet mass, there is basically no running anymore. What is more interesting are those of type 3a, which actually hit the boundary of theory space at a finite value k term, where they terminate and cannot be continued within the system of equations. Now this is a well-known phenomenon in this approach, well-known from QCD or scale theories, where these equations have been applied, and it's a typical symptom showing that the truncation is too simple, that you should add more terms, in particular you should add non-local terms probably.
Could you repeat again what goes wrong at
n
equals 1
half? Yeah, this is what is written here. What goes wrong is that the beta functions blow up And it's very instructive to translate this into the behavior of the dimension full quantities lambda and chi. Little lambda equals 1/2 means capital is 1/2 k squared. And when you plot the solutions to the flow equations in dimension full quantities, you see that for those trajectories, the capital lambda at some point runs into this boundary 1/2 k squared, and the precisely at k term. And what is even more interesting is, what does Newton's constant, when you lower k and approach the singularity, capital G increases its enormous dimension, goes to minus infinity, so its slope goes to minus infinity. So this means that at a certain point approaching the infrared, at a certain point, this truncation becomes unreliable. And before it becomes unreliable, there might be a certain regime. Experience with other similar theories tells you that to some extent there is still a certain grain of truth in this approximation. And this grain of truth means you have an increasing chi in the infrared. Once chi is renormalized too much, you should add higher invariance, non-local invariance, but this is extremely difficult technically and has not yet been done. But the message which I would like to extract from this discussion is that these flow equations, those which have been dealt with analytically so far, they predict that at a certain infrared scale, which we are going to determine now, there is a strong tendency for chi to grow. At a technical level, this kind of renormalization effect is well understood. We don't have the time to go into the details now. It's so-called instability-driven renormalization, well known from scalar theories and spontaneous symmetry breaking. So the basic mechanism which drives this increase is understood, but what we cannot assess with our methods is how strong this effect is and what is the ultimate fate of the trajectory here.
Isn't the scalar field the opposite case? Pardon? Isn't the scalar field the opposite case?
Yes, in that respect, it's very different. No, what I had in mind is there are strong renormalization effects as for making the bare potential convex. The effective potential is a convex function, and there are effects which make this famous flat bottom, and those effects are very similar to what is at work here.
One other question, your type 1 or whatever, the one that you said about the gradient, does lambda in principle go to minus infinity?
No, the dimension full one goes to a constant, the dimension less one to minus infinity.
If you look at the orthogonal behavior, are you hoping that through renormalization you might obtain the behavior of similarities?
Yes, that's happening, yes. That is basically, if you, this capital G goes down like 1 over k squared, and this is sort of what tames the conservative
value. Well, I didn't see that in your graph. I saw that G would have tended to a constant
at the large key. Yeah, this was just omitted.
The next was dimensional. The dimension is g goes to a fixed point g star. So yeah. G, which is dimensions of length, scales at 1 over k.
You were asking about this plot. Now this is just omitted in the ultraviolet. This for a long time goes straight and then it goes to zero. Oh, you are right. I mean, this is because I'm emphasizing the infrared now. But here you would. Okay, now. Let's try to find out where this breakdown of the Einstein-Hilbert truncation takes place. Now, the first observation in this context is that you can pick trajectories where this breakdown, this hitting of the singularity is as late as you like. This means if you pick a trajectory which spans a very long renormalization full time close to the Gaussian fixed point where the beta functions are small and the running is slow, you sit for a while here, infinitesimally close to the non-Gaussian one, cross over very rapidly, stay a long time here, and then are driven away to the singularity. And if you get close to this fixed point, you can have a scale here which is as small as you like. You can check on the computer. Also, what will be important later on, if you look at this turning point here, it has coordinates gt and lambda t, and the scale where the trajectory passes it is denoted kt. The result we need is that up to a constant of order unity, the two coordinates lambda t and gt are equal. So this means what you have to do is to squeeze this point very deeply into this wedge formed by the separatrix and the horizontal axis, then the termination will be at a very low scale. What I also will need later on, and is easy to obtain, is the flow linearized about the Gaussian fixed point. That's written here in terms of the dimensionless and the dimension full quantities. The dimension full g is actually constant in the regime where you can linearize about the origin. Here, by the way, this is the k to the 4 running the most primitive propagation theory would give rise to already. Now, which one of the trajectories is realized in nature now? Well, the observations tell us that in cosmology, so at a scale k of the order of the present Hubble scale, H naught is positive. Now, since in this class of trajectories, which I showed to you, the three A are the only ones which give rise to a positive lambda in the infrared, we conclude that it must be an extended version of this three A trajectories, which seems to be realized in nature. Yes?
Yeah, I think something that always confuses me about the cosmology and consequences is that there's a temptation to view it as a gravitational effect. On the other hand, you can put it sort of on the TVU, you can think of it as something that lives inside the field. Or,
yeah, I should say I'm discussing pure gravity.
So some sort of congested field. So here, and not that I'm advocating for either position, but here you're seeing the cosmological constant of something that lives on the left-hand side of the interstate equation in some sense. And that's that if there's any contribution to the cosmological constant that comes from the right-hand side, or what we think of as cosmological constant, just some slowly varying back energy, you could easily be living on the right-hand side of the outside of, and you could easily have one of the other flows in terms of where the outside equations would flow to, but still have a positive effect of the cosmological constant and the gravity constant.
Yes, I should have added, I mean, what I'm showing here is a pure gravity, and when I add matter, I'm assuming, this is an explicit assumption, I'm assuming that the cross features of pure gravity are not destroyed by matter. I mean, you always need, for practical purposes, you always need an assumption of that sort because we don't know what's the...
No, I agree, but I mean, assuming for argument's sake that you had something on the right-hand side that just like the cosmological constant.
No, I agree with you.
Then that means you could actually have a negative cosmological constant on the left hand side, or one with zero, and you can get your effective cosmological constant
inside. No, I agree.
No, I just wanted to be clear about what.
Yes, no, I agree.
Is it to the new views that the Hubble scale should be identified with your Carnot scale? Or
no, not that. It's basically the same as using, for instance, the inverse cosmological time in a Robertson-Walker framework. But it's, I mean, here is the steel, you have no other choice than picking this glass of projectors because the others, in a controlled way, run to negative or zero cosmological constant.
Yeah, in principle, the evidence for acceleration comes from modern redshift, maybe likely to a pattern of larger scale actually the universe is not. But I'm saying that I agree with the most natural scale. Evidence for the knowledge of the natural is also much smaller.
I mean, that's the right answer. I mean, it doesn't really matter what I put here. If you would like to put it to 1 centimeter square, it's absolutely the same for my curve. Okay, now the next task is to identify where is on this trajectory, which has been shaped now, where is classical general relativity valid? Now, classical general relativity means G and lambda doesn't run at all. Because of these definitions, this means lambda behaves like 1 over G, like 1 over K squared, so it gives rise to this canonical flow. Here, the blue line again is a canonical trajectory, and you see this part of the actual quantum trajectory is on top of a classical trajectory on this lower segment here between points P1 and P2. This is what we call the general relativity regime. Here there are basically no renormalization effects of the capital G and lambda. And in particular, the GR regime is part of the linear regime. I shall show you in a moment that G is something like 10 to the minus 70 and lambda much smaller than 1/2. Only when you extend further towards the singularity here, close to the question mark, there is a regime where we don't quite know what's going to happen. So now we can repeat the exercise you would do in quantum electrodynamics. You have, in principle, computed a family of trajectories. You ask yourself which one is realized. How you do it, you measure, for instance, the electron's mass and the electron's charge. Here the same. We, in principle, we should measure at a certain scale, k lab for laboratory, in a laboratory of linear dimension, k lab to the minus 1. I measure capital G, capital lambda, multiply by the corresponding factors of k, and get the dimensionless pair G and lambda. And having such a pair, you uniquely fix a certain trajectory. Here the formula for little g is rewritten in terms of the Planck length and mass, which we define in the usual way in terms of the laboratory values of g. And laboratory scales always are supposed to mean scales where general relativity is tested and found to be valid. For instance, on a terrestrial 1 meter scale, you would find in this manner from the observed value of G something like 10 to the minus 70, at one astronomical unit something like 10 to the minus 92, with no visible variation of capital G. Now that's only half of the story. Of course, you also would like to use information on the measured cosmological constant, but for the time being, I'm not using a measured value of lambda, because I will argue that the scale, present cosmological scales, are not necessarily in the domain of validity of our Einstein-Hilbert approximation. However, it's easy to derive a bound for little lambda, namely, assuming it's non-zero, has this value, then space-time is curved with a radius of curvature RC of this order, or little lambda to the minus 1/2 times the length scale of your laboratory. But observation tells you the radius of curvature here in this room is much larger than the dimensions of this room. So you conclude that lambda is much smaller than unity. So taken together, both chi and lambda are much, much smaller than 1 for all scales in the GR scheme. As a result, the anomalous dimension is pretty small too, explaining why you don't see any running of capital G and capital lambda. So in this segment here, you have general relativity, valid lambda here and lambda there are smaller than 1, implying that also the lambda and the G value at the turning point are much smaller than 1. Now, this results in the first important result about the properties of our trajectory, namely this turning point has, just from phenomenology, we learn that chi and lambda are much smaller than 1. Later on, I will show that it's something like 10 to the minus 6 chi. So this is a number not of order unity, and you might ask why nature has chosen such an unnatural, non-generic value. And the answer I'm proposing here is, of course, we don't know why it's realized in nature, but assuming it was not like that, if G and lambda was of order unity, say, then you would never arrive at a world which contains a classical regime. If G and lambda are as small as that, then the trajectory gets very close to the Gaussian fixed point, spends a very long time there, and as I told you, it delays the termination point to a very small scale. K termination is much smaller than the Planck mass. So the reason, in a sense, the reason why nature likes this unnaturalness is to produce in this manner a classical domain. One can then use the linearized flow equations, I'm not going through the technicalities here, to derive the ratios between the termination scale and the turning point scale given by the square root of gt, which is much smaller than 1, and on the second side, also the ratio between the turning point and the Planck mass is given by the same quantity, square root gt. So what you find here is an exactly symmetric double hierarchy between the three scales, the Planck mass, the turning point, and the termination scale. It's all controlled by gt. So here you see quite explicitly that the trajectory must get very close to the Gaussian fixed point, making gt small, so that you get a long classical regime suppressing k term over the turning point scale. Conversely, for a generic initial condition without such a fine tuning, the termination scale, turning point scale is about M Planck. Renormalization effects are always strong, first the ultraviolet ones, then the infrared ones, and you would nowhere have a regime where the classical theory is valid approximately. Now there comes a nice surprise if you look for consequences of this fine tuning, namely now it seems the fine tuning of this trajectory, making it approach the Gaussian fixed point with a very high accuracy, this fine tuning in the first place is needed to produce a classical world in a certain domain. What you get for free now is that the cosmological constant in this world, this classical world, is automatically small. Namely, again using the linearized flow equation, you can easily show that lambda over M Planck in the GR scheme is again controlled by this factor GT. Here it's GT squared, which is enormously much smaller than 1. So the conclusion is if you find yourself in a world where classical general relativity is applicable, you know that there is a sufficiently long classical regime. You know that the trajectory gets very close to the Gaussian fixed point, otherwise the normalization effects are always strong, and as a consequence of that, you automatically, just from the shape basically of this trajectory, you conclude that at least the laboratory value of lambda is much smaller than the Planck mass as deduced from the Xi in this classical regime. So stated differently, the smallness of lambda is not a separate naturalness problem beyond this naturalness problem related to the very existence of a classical regime.
Can you quantify that in the sense that is there a range of lambda which you have a natural regime for which the cosmological constant is still be all the variation C in the universe? Like, I think the problem with a lot of these seems similar to Weber's and Proctor's argument, is the cosmological constant can't be a lot bigger than the one we see, because otherwise you wouldn't have time for galaxies to form. But if cosmological constant is very big, then you get Sinner space, say the cosmological constant is the TV scale, that means that as the universe passes through the TV scale, as it expands, it becomes the Sinner space, with the TV scale energy, you never form the galaxies and planets and people, so you're just going to see that universe. But on the other hand, it seems like that maybe the cosmological constant could be a lot smaller. The question is do we saturate that gap, or is there more tuning involved in seeing our cosmological constant than simply satisfying that condition? You need to have lambda.
Can I suggest it? Because I think you're pretty near it. This is not a special discussion. So why don't we let it finish?
So the contents of the previous transparency you can also summarize by a much simpler formula. You can ask yourself, how is the termination scale, that's perhaps a partial answer to your question, termination scale related to the laboratory lambda we observe? And just by saying lambda, the little lambda is the capital one over k squared. When is this of order one? Now, clearly when k is of the order square root lambda, at that scale I would expect the strong effects to become visible. And now I can ask, what's this scale in our universe? Well, the observations tell us the spectral energy density is of the order of the critical density, which is equivalent to saying that lambda is of the order h0 squared. Now if you insert h0 on the right-hand side here, you deduce that the termination scale is of the order of the Hubble scale. Now again, as you emphasize, this assumes the essential mechanism of all this renormalization is pure gravity. And in this respect, as for this instability, matter cannot change anything because this mechanism can be driven only by massless fields. We have the graviton and we have the photon, but the photon couples only to charged massive loops, and so that might not be very efficient. So I think this is a fairly safe prediction, and the prediction would be that the effects become strong in our world at a scale which is more or less of the radius and length scales. Now, if you assume that the difference between lab and cosmological values is not very significant, one or two orders of magnitude perhaps, then the lab value can be identified with h0 squared. This ratio is well known, the famous 100 orders of magnitude, which implies the German prime coordinates are 10 to the minus 60, and the double hierarchy is a factor of 10 to the 30 in either case. It's quite funny, by the way, to find in this manner the length scale associated to the turning point is 10 to the minus 3 centimeters. Now, assume this is correct, then in cosmology you would somehow expect to see something like strong renormalization effects at solar system scales where TRs tested, they are invisible. So the suspicion is that somewhere between solar system and cosmology scales, those effects should show up. And from this discussion, you also would learn that this breakdown of the approximation is at G's 10 to the minus 120 and the little lambda of order 1. That will become interesting in a moment. So somewhere here, we are tempted to look for these effects. Now there is some older work we did with Alfred Bonanno a couple of years ago on a purely phenomenological basis on the possibility of infrared quantum effects in cosmology, and we believe that really at cosmological scale such effects are indeed taking place. We believe it on the basis of a just phenomenological analysis of what potentially could happen here at the end point of the trajectory or close to this point where it breaks down. What we did here is to make a model, the simplest possible model, and we assume that this trajectory, when it gets close to the boundary, just stops running, that an infrared cut, an infrared fixed point develops. And this is not yet computed on the basis of flow equations. This is just a phenomenological hypothesis. And if you follow this hypothesis of this infrared fixed point, then you get a lot of phenomenologically attractive features, for instance, an acceleration, an automatic mechanism which equates approximately omega meta to omega lambda. It predicts by internal consistency that this point is precisely where the Einstein interpunctation breaks down, and it also gives you a ratio of Latin cosmological values of g of the order 10.
The current, I mean, you say that the universe is currently expanding at t to the.
I shouldn't say currently, I should say that provided the universe enters this fixed point regime, at the fixed point it would go like.
Because I mean, the suggestion that the universe is cosmological constant dominated suggests that the universe is actually, and it's the way that the scale, the age of t to the 4/5 is too low. That's just being inconsistent with the measured value of probably. The equation of state.
No. Actually, it is not the equation of state is dubbed is with the W equals minus 1. But G is running and lambda is running, and we, for instance, we fitted this.
So this is with the running G as well as with the running.
Yes, and we fitted that to the supernova data, and it fits the supernova and the radio galaxy data at least as good as the best FRW model.
Could you fit the CFP data as well?
We didn't do yet that, but it for sure will fit according to present knowledge, because it will influence only the difference between standard model and ours is only very recent, or the change is only at a redshift of 1 compared to the usual one. Okay, now my last topic is the last topic is, could we see at somewhat smaller scales also, if it's really true that at cosmological scales we see a non-trivial renormalization group running, is there also evidence at smaller scales, perhaps galactic scales? You all know the famous phenomenon, you have a galaxy with a luminous core, you see some test particles orbiting around it, and you know this famous almost flat rotation curves which contradict Kepler's law and have led to the invention of dark matter, for instance. Now, in the following, I would like to discuss the possibility that this effect is actually due to a renormalization of a G, mainly of G, and not to the presence of any dark matter. Now what we should do in principle is to first derive and then solve the effective field equations of 2EQ, but clearly this is an impossible task, and if we were able to do that, we also would be able to prove confinement analytically somehow a problem of this non-perturbative nature. However, there is an obvious educated guess about what is the non-local curve which might be responsible for this phenomenon. Namely, what we do is we make an ansatz for G as a function of K. A phenomenological ansatz, we convert this K dependence to an X dependence by saying the scale is something like 1 over distance. If we are precise, we take the proper distance, R being a radial, Schwarzschild type radial coordinate. But I have to emphasize what I tell you about in the last 5 minutes is purely phenomenological. We just try to extract from observed data the trajectory which is responsible for it, if it is true that these phenomena are due to a running of G. And most probably all the higher gravitational couplings, lambda and so on, are not important for the business of the galaxy. So what I will retain is only the running of G. Now what could you do? What ansatz would you consider natural? There are various arguments which I don't have the time to review now, but the most primitive thing is to say eta is zero, the anomalous dimension, then nothing runs. The next is to say eta is constant for a certain range of lengths. So this is what I'm going to try. Eta being negative, so that you increase G in the infrared, minus Q, Q being positive. This translates to a power law for capital G. And what I'm going to tell you now is that this ansatz very nicely describes flat rotation curves. This is natural from the mathematical and from the flow torsion point of view. This could be due to a new fixed point, for instance. And it is actually some
point is in the name of the time is that that's the suspension.
Now what we are trying to do here is there are various ways of implementing this renormalization group information. You could improve solutions to the Einstein equations, you could improve the Einstein equations themselves, and the third step is you could improve the variational principle, and this is the most general and most sophisticated version. That's what, in collaboration with the student at Mainz, Holger Weyer, we developed for this purpose, is the improvement of actions. Namely, we take the action with the x dependent G and lambda, derive the modified field equations. The details for the time being are not important. There is a certain subtlety about how to deal with the momentum stored in G and lambda. I'm not going into that. This is not important for the present purposes. All I would like to show you about this theory with G and X, with G and lambda being X dependent, is its modified Newtonian limit. You can say, I assume G is only weakly position dependent, being of this form, constant G bar, and then 1 plus a small function n. Now this I use in my flow equations, in my modified Einstein equation, and I apply the usual set of steps to derive the Newtonian limit. So V squared phi and n are assumed much smaller than 1. I make this ansatz for the metric, dust for the matter. And what I find is for the Newtonian potential, this Poisson equation, where on the right hand side of the matter consists of two cases, the method energy density contains rho of ordinary matter and then an additional term involving derivatives of G. And this is the interesting piece because the effective energy density contains a piece which could mimic dark matter, and this piece results from the space variation of Newton's constant. Actually, this equation is very easy to solve. The solution is always of this structure. If I had being a solution in absence of the renormalization effects, the full solution is phi hat plus 1/2 n. For instance, this would be the potential of a point source. You can now make a simple model of a spherically symmetric galaxy, for instance. You can assume some density profile of luminous matter. Then phi is given by this expression, and it's this expression, and this then is the modified rotation curve. And now, up to this point, everything is completely general. If I use this trajectory, replace g by 1 over r, ordinary Schwarzschild coordinate, I get this n function, and in the end, this form for the rotation curve and here for the potential logarithmic correction. And this is the shape of the g of r. I can use this velocity function to re-express the exponent q in terms of the velocity on the plateau. The infinity squared is q over 2, so with the usual range of velocities, you learn that q is of the order of 10 to the minus 6. So what you learn from this exercise is that an incredibly tiny variation of g, just one part in 10 to the 6 between the center of a galaxy and its outskirts, g should change by just one part in a million. That would be enough to produce these flat rotation curves under the condition that we correctly guess the relevant non-local term by saying the non-locality in the metric enters in this form 1 over this is. So much for the Newtonian limit, and the very last transparency I'd like to show you, just to tell you that we also did some serious work, sort of. You can solve these modified Einstein equations also exactly, at least for a certain energy momentum tensor for G and lambda, and one class of solution for the k to the minus 2 trajectory is written down here. What is written in the square brackets here is nothing but the Schwarzschild metric, and W is a conformal factor. So all I would like to tell you here is that the exact solutions, or a large class of exact solutions to this exact, to these modified Einstein equations, are conformal to standard Schwarzschild or Minkowski space times. And this gives a nice explanation to the idea that these quantum fluctuations which drive the renormalization, that they substitute dark matter. And if they substitute dark matter, then, I mean, trivially what you must make sure is that it is dark, this substitute matter. And dark means those fluctuations shouldn't couple to the photon. And because the renormalization effect just manifests itself in a conformal factor, this is automatically built in, so the photon has no vortex to these fluctuations. And in this sense, for instance, the m equals zero fluctuation, the m equals zero case of this metric is a kind of pure dark matter, ALO. It describes a kind of solitonic excitation of space without any luminous matter present. with something which perhaps in the early stages of structure formation could be interesting to use.
What impact about structure formation?
The answer is very simple. I mean, in the standard scenario, you first form dark matter halos and then let the matter form into these halos.
You say that apparently you don't need that.
No, I don't need dark matter. And this metric I showed to you is the substitute of pure dark matter halos. So you could rotate certain aspects of the standard scenario in the sense that you first form these structures without luminous maps and then have this metal fall into the potential.
It seems much harder on the same thing. Wait.
You don't have to make long matches. Put the conclusion. I can be very brief. I told you that perhaps the most important part of the title was the question mark at the end. Now the conclusion is I am not in a position to tell you whether or not the effects I was going to motivate whether they really would occur in nature. But according to our experience with similar theories like UCB, for instance, it's quite likely that they are there. From a formal point of view, they are well understood, but we don't know how strong they are. And my message is, before you do any modifications of the standard scenario, standard model of particle physics or standard model of cosmology like dark matter, physics and inflation and so on, before you do model building on that, I think one should know how large these potential quantum effects are, because only after knowing that you know how much of quintessence fields and how much of cosmological constant from matter and so on you really need to make contact with nature. Thank you.
You're curious, sorry, more discussion. But that's thank you for your talk.
I guess our question about dark matter halos, like whether you have single galaxies in the absence of dark matter, maybe what more interesting would be to look at the formation of the acoustic peaks in the microwave background. Because those are understood as you have baryons that are falling into and out of these potential worlds that have been created by the dark matter. But if you take the dark matter out, you don't have any potential worlds. Then these guys are just, the baryons are just going to repel each other, so they're not going to want them. They'll push each other apart, but you won't have the restoring force provided by the dark matter perturbations in the early universe before we can combination to produce the peaks that you see in the CMB. And so it seems like that if you're relying on, if you do all the job of the dark matter by having something other than dark matter, then you want to know where is the restoring force coming for these acoustic oscillations, which are happening at much smaller physical interscales than a dark matter halo in the universe today. So it seems to me that one of the things that you could really frequently look at with this would be with your expected CMB to look the same.
I agree that would be very interesting to get some handle on, but what you are proposing is this method has natural limitations, and in particular it allows only for the method of guessing what is the cutoff.
You can take the same form as the calculation you've used here to fit the dark matter halos, but then you want to see whether that gives you a consistent story for the behavior. Because the other place in the universe that the dark matter is very important is to produce what we see in the microwave background. Like, if you take the dark matter out of the universe, the microwave background just looks completely different. When you go run CMB fast with COVID.
If you promise to me that it keeps being a single scale problem, then we would be able to do it in this formalism. But the general restriction of this this approach of the normalization coefficient is we should, by some general principles, we should be able to guess what is the relation between geometric quantities and k, and a typical few or more scale problems cannot be dealt with in this manner, and that's why this is just a shortcut to something much more terrible in general, and I'm not sure I could
I have a question concerning the cutoff function. I'm not an example, I'm deep reading. My recollection is that QCD is a subtlety which is gauge invariance and the choice of the cutoff function. Are there any difficulties with general quantum invariance here?
No, I mean, I was very brief on this technical issue. So what we actually do is we use, first of all, a background gauge formalism. So what we actually evolve is a function depending on two metrics, G mu nu and G mu nu bar. And then the cutoff is constructed in terms of it's a D'Alembert in the background of G bar acting on G minus G bar. And with this construction, there is no problem with gauge invariance. I mean, this is really solved, this problem, but the technical price is quite high.
Okay,
John,
I just wanted to try Richard's question. You have to remember that here, the gravitational constant can be increasing to full surface of our sky, so we can keep the gravitational potential around. Also, the gravitational potential is not real. It's not a fact. So we have to redo the calculation of the fact to see how close it gets to having collision and start getting rid of the silk iron type. So this has to be redone.
It's not like it was easy. Right. I'm just like, it'll be the other place that Dark Knight is really important.
Well, but the conclusion of Dark Knight is absolutely necessary. It's not necessarily true.
Yeah, I
can
understand.
I have a question concerning the starting point. So the effective action means integrating over the matching. Then in order to do the trial cutoff, you have to choose one background measure. You know, the scale is with respect to some measure. So in any usual theory, there's no problem because there is a background measure, you know, it's very when you talk about the scale case, with respect to this
you are right. This is a notoriously confusing point, and I mean, to describe all these technicalities, that would be a talk in its own. And the answer to your question is we have these two metrics, G and G bar. Actually, it's more complicated to the path integral than what I wrote down. It's a gauge-fixed path integral, and just for the gauge-fixing, it involves anyhow the G bar, standard background gauge-fixing. And then we introduce a cutoff in the following way. The official notation is you start with something we call gamma. This is the microscopic metric. And in the gauge fixing term, you introduce the background field and you also add the corresponding ghost action. And now, as always in the background business, we decompose the actual variable of integration in this manner, where h mu nu is not assumed to be small. It's just a decomposition. You separate off g bar, and this is integrated without any restrictions. And in this field, you use in order to write down the cutoff action, that's delta Ks in our notation. And this cutoff action is roughly something like h mu nu, and then comes this operator Rk, which is a function of minus the D'Alembert squared, but the D'Alembert constructed from the background metric. And K is, if this is the spectrum of minus e bar squared, then you have certain modes and you cut them off at the scale k. This bar here is also important for technical reasons, because only if you put the r here and not e, it gives you an equation, a flow equation with only the second function of derivatives on the right hand side. That is important. Now, you add this and you add sources, and this somehow defines a generating functional WK of the sources. This WK depends on the sources and G bar, and the Lachambre transform it, and you end up with something which is essentially, after the Lachambre transform, the classical version of H mu nu and the background field. And now, according to the standard theorem about the background gauge, if you put this thing to zero, you end up with a functional which depends only on one metric, namely the background metric. And this functional, like the naive gamma k, which you should define without the sophisticated gauge, this functional generates the one-topic irreducible Green's functions of this theory. So what I was always talking about is this object without writing the bar. But this is a background independent construction in the end. Yes, in the end you set this thing to zero, so in the end this k refers to the physical metric, but to start with it is the background metric.
Are you sure it's independent? Suppose you use the background that was just geometrically different, not simply, it's not a question of just making it different on the background. But suppose you use the background which starts with instead of the parts here, or just the gravitational layer or something like that. Are you sure that you wouldn't get a different meaning together for the layer?
I mean, it should be different from what? I mean, this construct.
Well, in the end, the background wrapped up. I mean, in the end, you claim to get just an expression gamma sub k of g bar, whatever you call it.
No, I mean,
is
G bar itself a vector? Yes, G bar is an externally fixed background. It's not specified. In no stage of this calculation is G bar specified. I mean, this is very different from standard line root calculations. We never specify any metric. This projection of the renormalization root flow onto the subspace, this is totally independent of any specific metrics. It is something which holds for all metrics.
This is the thing you use in your effective action, your representation, the scanning of the background itself.
Yes.
So you don't use G-bar to be original, for instance, the one you have seen.
But this is, I mean, this is the standard philosophy. That is not our intention, and the same as in Yang Mills.
There's something different about Yang Mills. There is something different because in Yang Mills case, K is referred to a metric that's not itself dynamical.
Yes, in the perspective.
I had another question, which is, I just didn't understand. At some point you had a momentum dependent running Newton's constant and cosmological constant. And then you jumped from that to a position dependent gravitational constant. I just didn't understand that.
Yeah, this is the gravitational
constant. Are you saying, what determines the position?
Yeah. This is the gravitational analog of a simple calculation one can do in QED, for instance. In QED, I know the electric charge runs like something like log k. in massless QED. And now I can use this information to get the Ewing servo potential. I know classically somehow the potential is E over R, the Coulomb potential. And now the idea is to make this E run and identify this scale with the only scale which is available to me in a massless theory. And if the electron is massless, I have a proton here and the electron there, then the only available scale is this distance. So if you set this equals to 1 over r, the improvement would lead to something like log 1 over r over r, and this is the correct one loop effective potential in massless QED. You can check this with the standard textbook calculations using the vacuum polarization tensor. So this is correct, and you confirm in this manner that this is the correct transcription from momentum to position space descriptions. And this is something which works only if you have only one scale. Then on general principles, you can guess what is the scale which cuts off the...
You're saying if there was nothing but a point gas generated the objective, but then you could guess this particular position again. But as long as... the real problem is not like that. The mass of the galaxy is distributed.
Yes, yes, and this is what I said.
You really need to know what is this non-local term that you...
Yeah, this non-locality comes...
Is there some way, even in principle, of passing from that running constant to write down an effective, a non-local effective action that would capture that?
Yes, the calculation you should do in principle, that's the one where you take the full gamma at k0 and derive from this action, you derive the effective field equations and solve them.
Well, then that's
but that's the horrible task.
I don't mean that, but
yes.
Then you can throw out everything you did so far and just start over.
Yes.
You're playing the particular rule of running.
No, I said it's an educated guess.
Suppose you knew how to
run
the value of g of k.
There were two assumptions. The first assumption was this trajectory, and the second is the covariant generalization of this one, that k is something like 1 over the distance in Newtonian approximation 1 over r. So this is what I call the educated guess, because it is plausible, at least at the Newtonian level, it is plausible that this is the relevant scale which you have 2 point masses.
But suppose you took only one, you assume 1.1, not 0.2, and try to consider what we call a multi-scale, the general distribution. Mm-hmm. Is there a well-defined, in principle, is there a well-defined generalization of the Einstein equation that would govern that once you know one? Or do you have to go back to the original gamma knowledge of
you are absolutely right. This shortcut works for single scale problems. For instance, here, massive QED. In massive QED, you would not be able to guess the analog in this manner. You just could do the full-fledged calculation, but not this shortcut. That's why I said I can do only the single scale problems, which is...
Because there's something that's very worrying here. Potentially be very worrying, which is if you could do this full thing, you would end up with some non-local. In order to have a running G, it must mean that you have non-local terms in the effective action.
Not necessarily, but according to what we know from other theories, it's yes, for sure.
But anyway, let's say it gives non-local terms. then you know, then there's a potential of seeing macroscopic non-local gravitational effects. And then we have to ask whether or not we could look for those. What should we have seen them? Don't we get violations of causality, for example?
So very interesting, important question, but I cannot give you a really satisfactory answer. But yes, in principle.
I want to come back to this background mechanism. So there is a difference with usual effective action geometry of some C5. That here, it seems that because of gravity, I can get rid of the K, right? Because if instead of G bar I take K G bar, then gamma 1 of K G bar is the same as gamma K of G bar. Because changing the, I'm isolating G bar by some constant, it's equivalent to which by K.
All the couplings, all the dimensionful couplings, I mean, you
know. What I'm saying is that you have the equality which is gamma K of C G bar is equal to gamma K over C G bar.
No, that's not all. That's
because of your prescription. I mean, if I multiply the dimension by constants, then it's equivalent to put to multiply the dimension operator by constant square. So fixing it to be, you know, of level K.
I see your point, but if you rescale the bar, then also other terms get rescaled, and in particular the basic term gets rescaled, and so you have to do also a rescaling of the variable of integration HU, and so the full story of the equation you are proposing is something like that. If you have gamma k, now think of it as depending on the metric, and think of it as depending on the, call it ci, all these couplings including the Lewis constant, cosmological constant, hydrodynamic couplings, and so on. And this is somehow, if you multiply everything by its economical dimension, c times k, and c to the minus 2 g mu nu, and then c to the minus canonical dimension of, oh no, that was stupid, let's call it ui of ui. And this is the homogeneity relation.
Yeah, that's very different from the usual case in the sense that I can always choose k to be 1, right?
Yes.
So
yes,
there's only one thing.
You are right, this is a very important issue, and actually there's a paper by Takashi and Carini where they show that because of this fact, Newton's constant, the running of Newton's constant, is physically effect, and she is an essential coupling in Weinberg sense. So there is, you can do it. You can do this, but this gives a different way of looking at the same physics and would not help making a story. Because
in my thing is that this is where gravity is really different from anything else.
Yes, absolutely.
There should be, so that's where something different should appear. Right? I would expect at some point that the story is not exactly the same as, I don't know, QCD, because I'm talking about gravity. Exactly because of that. Because when I talk about scale, I talk about scale fixed by a dynamical field. So I don't freely move the scale without moving my field. They are kind of tied up together. There's only one scale. This is the metric, right? This is the metric. And the metric is so, yeah.
the usual story, you can think about the field and the scale as being.
No, of course, I'm not saying that everything is completely as in Janus theory. I mean, this is an aspect which is quite different. I mean, where I was referring to Janus is just to motivate the idea of strong infrared normalization effects, but also in this respect, for instance, some issues are totally different. For instance, this famous lambda QCD, this induced dimensional parameter, there is a certain induced scale also in gravity, but to be precise, there are two scales. And these two scales happen to be degenerate in Yang-Mills, and the two scales are the Planck length and this scale where the infrared effects show up. And this is an issue or a property which is quite different from Yang-Mills. They are degenerate in Yang-Mills. The lambda QCD plays a double role, and it's the lower bound of the asymptotic scaling region, and it's also the scale where the infrared effects become strong. And that these two scales are identical is typical of Yang-Mills, but it's different in gravity. And as you say, also in this respect, that's of course very different from Yang-Mills.
Well, I don't know enough about the gauge theory case, but are you saying in the gauge theory you could not do a fine tuning analogous to what you did here to separate those two length scales?
That's a very good question. I was thinking about it, but I don't know the answer. But in any case, nature seems not to do it. Nature does not do it.
Because without fine-tuning, the two scales
would degenerate. But that is a good question. It would be interesting, but it seems also on the lattice and also the flow equation studies seem to suggest that generically, somehow.
Maybe there's only one couple of questions.
This is an issue of truncations. I mean, strictly speaking, in both theories, we have infinitely many couplings which run. And also, again, Mills, I mean, we did similar flow equation studies for the Mills with f squared, f to the 4, and f to the 6. But in general, it's always infinitely many.
Because I feel uncomfortable with thinking about the running of G alone. If I think about G just as saving from me a unit of mass.
There you are, right.
Running of G means I'm changing my units. So it doesn't mean. Right, I have to think about running of G with respect to some physics.
Yes.
So with respect to numbers. So in this translation, the only thing which runs is this G number.
Yes. Yes, and so this is actually something that, for instance, the position of the fixed point, these coordinates of the fixed point, this is something you can change by changing this cutoff function in a different way. But the product, G star times lambda star, this is the same as capital G times capital lambda, because the phi squared cancel, this is precisely what you are proposing. This is a universal quantity, and the main reason why we believe that this is not a coincidence and not a truncation artifact, this fixed point, is you can change this cutoff scheme in a tremendous way, so that phi separately and lambda separately change enormously, and nevertheless the product stays constant with a very high accuracy. And this is precisely what you are saying, namely the only measurable thing is this is sort of measuring lambda in units of the Planck length. This is physical, and this comes out universal in the language of statistical mechanics, but not the thing separately.
When you take this point of view, can you tell the same story? Like, if you really, say that.
You mean not using K, but.
Yeah, using K.
Yes.
Is it possible?
Yeah. Yes, it is. it is a little bit a strange way of talking and not so transparent, but you are right. I mean, you could replace everything in terms of occasionally on the transparency side, I was saying lambda lab in units of M Planck, and M Planck is the key in the lab. It's always referred to the same scale, and this is a similar. But you are right, I mean, it's very difficult to really find observables, and this product is observable, and typically it's following such a fixed point for it. This, for pure gravity, it's something like 0.12.
So it's very different compared to
I mean, if the infrared fixed point would exist, then that would be. Yeah, I mean, this is in this plot when it slows down. I mean, this coordinate, this is order one, and here it is in the orders of magnitude. In that sense, this is sort of the substitute for quintessence. I mean, quintessence is a dynamic way of making lambda small, and this slow down is what it would correspond to.
Try to be your, you know,
yeah.